Happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 316 on January 10th, 2024. My name is Jason Neifer, and I am the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is the Montana State Virtual School located on the beautiful University of Montana campus right here in western Montana. And joining me tonight, as always, good evening, Dr. Fryer. How are you tonight, sir?
Well, good evening, Jason. As long as I don't close my webcam app like I've been doing a couple times, I think I'll be good. So I am a middle school STEM and media literacy teacher here at Providence Day School in Charlotte, North Carolina, but I'm coming to you from Matthews, where we had really significant severe weather yesterday that actually there was allegedly a tornado a couple miles west of us, and 68,000 people without power this morning, and that included our school. And so we ended up having school canceled yesterday because of the severe weather threat, and then today because there wasn't power. So we are into the new semester, and I'm excited to be continuing, especially with my computer programming class, but others as well. So you are looking quite dapper tonight, sir. What's the occasion?
Well, I testified in front of the Montana legislature today on artificial intelligence and education. So I joined two of my wonderful colleagues, Mike Agustinelli and Caitlin Byers, who work at the Digital Academy, and we were invited to share some perspectives today on artificial intelligence and education. It was a wonderful hour and 15 minutes or so, incredible questions from the legislators, and even though I sometimes wish we had a yearly legislature, because I think it would help out in some processes, we have an every other year legislature. This is an off year, so this was an interim committee that was meeting. But I think we will benefit from that because as a lot of states grapple with artificial intelligence, and I've seen a couple of articles about how state legislatures are likely to tackle this issue during their 2024 sessions, we'll have the benefit of other states' policies. And so we feel very fortunate that to be able to provide some perspective today. And again, really great questions from legislators on that particular topic. So I was coat and tied up today. I combed my hair. I put gel in my hair today, which is not really the Jason Neifer way on most days, but it was nice to have an opportunity. Oh, by the way, Siri turned on for some reason. Okay, now it's off. I'm using AirPods right now because my microphone stopped working. So yes, so that's what we did today. So that's why I am dressed up today, although I'm in kind of my post testimony button.
Are you at home or are you on the road?
Yes. Nope. Oh, I made it. I pulled into the driveway about 30 minutes ago. So
okay, there you go. All right. Well, what are we up to? We had a bit of a different show last week, but I think we'll be normal. So what's the normal? Well, okay. I got to get a weather report first. Are you guys like? It's getting like to negative 12 in Colorado Springs with this next storm, according to our daughter. What's it like in Big Sky Country?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. Last week, I was in Great Falls all week, where my parents are at. It's also a town I grew up in. And as it turns out, right when I was leaving on Sunday, it started dumping snow. There wasn't snow after about a half an hour as I drove back to Missoula, Montana. But the weather is going to be pretty cold here. It's not as bad as we thought it might be because it was reporting at negative 30. Overnight.
That's without wind chill?
That's without wind chill in Great Falls. And it's, no, it's back. Saturday's supposed to be negative 36. Holy dog. So that's really cold. And so, yeah, we're going to get some serious weather in the next couple of weeks here in Montana. But, you know, we're prepared for it because, you know, that's the way things go.
Wow. All right. Well, we're enjoying staying in the 40s and 50s here in the Piedmont of North Carolina. So I think I'll postpone any upcoming travel that I had to Big Sky Country and, you know, wait for the summer.
Yeah, I think that's a wise move.
All right. Well, hey, we are all caught up on our podcasts, edtechsr.com. which is exciting. So what do we have in store for episode 315 or 316, I should say?
Well, inevitably, we'll talk about some AI this time around. So we will definitely take a look at the ongoings of AI. Lots of interesting news in the last few weeks. We also have some tech correction and big tech news, some Apple news, which is always interesting to dig down into, media listening news, and then we'll end our podcast tonight with our so-called Geeks of the Week. Dr. Fryer, you did most of our linkage tonight. What or where would you like to start tonight?
Well, a lot of these are carryovers from last week because we debriefed our play date that we had on December 27th. This is a quick one. This is from Apple Insider on December 28th. And I actually think the tagline or the headline here is a bit misleading. It says, AirTag saves Christmas, tracks down luggage stolen from the Charlotte airport. Well, yes, it tracked it down, but the luggage was empty by the time they found it. We've talked about AirTags a number of times on the show. In fact, I think there are some airlines that have actually tried to ban them, apparently because they've been embarrassed by how accurately they have shown, you know, mismanagement or mishandling of luggage. But there was a family that was flying into the Charlotte airport, and they had an AirTag in their bag, and they actually followed it to the person's house, and that is not recommended by the police. They ended up reporting this to the police when they identified where it was, and they were arrested. But anyway, just another headline about an AirTag on a positive note, being used for luggage tracking. So nothing
well, too earth-shattering there. And what I would also say that I'm sure is not a surprise at all, but I mean, it's saved my bacon more than it's creeped me out. And so that's kind of my balance right now with AirTags. And I also think that Apple is spending more time trying to think about safety and security than other available marketplace devices, including the kind of early market leaders in this space. And then I just like to remind everyone who is maybe creeped out by AirTags or thinks that they are a bad technology, you may have a point about it, but there's still much more effective ways to be a creeper on Amazon. There are tons of devices that you can buy on Amazon where you can slip a SIM a card in and you know, have it hook up to a network and just stick it up in someone's wheel well and live track someone 24/7. And I'm not saying that I'm advocating for that technology. I think that technology is wrong, but I do feel like Apple is putting more thought into the safety and security of these devices than perhaps the rogue SIM card based GPS device folks are on Amazon.
And if you're an Android user, I think it's a good idea to go ahead and download that app that'll allow you to be alerted if you happen to have an AirTag following you. But yeah, it is, unfortunately, there are lots of dark sides to technology and the whole arena of stalking and tracking and things like that. There's unfortunately a lot of software hacks and even services that people can contract for that are just not great. So anyway. One positive AirTag. Do you want to do that other Apple article about the tradition?
Yes, although I don't remember what this is about. Oh, I know now. So Apple broke its own tradition and didn't release a single iPad in 2023. And so that's something that they have done every year for the past – oh, no, it was an iPad.
Well, no, it said it was, yeah, Macs. For 21 years, no new Macs in the fourth quarter.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's the first time since, and, 20, yeah, 2000.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I do think that there is a lot – well, I mean, there's so much hand-wringing about Apple and what it does and doesn't do. To be honest, you know, one of the reasons why I came back to the Mac platform after years in the wilderness, otherwise known as my Windows and Chrome OS years, was that I didn't like the direction that recent Macs were going, the butterfly keyboard issue, and I also felt like that they weren't innovating much in that space. But the M1 Mac changed almost everything for me, and now I'm very much back in the Mac ecosystem. But I also think that a lot of the hand-wringing around, you know, what it releases and when, the people that are tracking dates and yada, 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 It's a little much, I think, but I am very excited that I do think that there will be some interesting M3 Max released in 2024. And I also hear some rumors that we could expect some interesting new form factors, including for the iPad. So I would like to see some updates certainly in that space as well.
From a return on investment standpoint, both as, you know, educators, administrators, and then just, you know, home consumers, I think the news is all good. And that is especially if you've got an M1 or an M2, I just don't think you're gonna want to have a new machine unless you're a power user and you're wanting pro because of video processing and all that kind of encoding and that kind of thing. But my wife, I'm using her M1 now, just absolutely love it. And I was able to help our youngest daughter, our only remaining college student right now, buy a new Mac over, I think she got actually over Thanksgiving, but it's just fantastic. And I am fully confident that that's going to, you know, see her through 4 years of college. So the return on investment on these devices, whether you're talking about a school purchasing for faculty, you might have them for students. I don't know that it's really as common to find Mac laptop one-to-one student initiatives. They're out there. But, I've been at schools now for over 10 years, I guess, where all faculty have had a Mac Air. So it's a great laptop.
So I will tell you something I've run into with, I have a personal MacBook Air M1. It's the base model with 8 gigabytes of RAM. And I also have a Mac Mini M1 with 16 gigs of RAM. And I will tell you something I ran into last week, and it seems like I'm running into them on both of my devices, but last week I was remote for the week. I was hanging out and with my parents in Great Falls. And I obviously carry more than one laptop because I'm that guy, but I noticed, as I was using my personal M1, MacBook Air last week that it started slowing down dramatically last week. And I couldn't really figure out what it was. There was plenty of space left. I did get minimal hard drives, which is a decision I might make differently next time. And I had never thought that the 8 gigabytes of RAM was ever a limitation. I had been using the device for almost a year and a half, and it was great. But it started slowing down to an absolute crawl, and Google Drive stopped working for me. And so the app would work, but I would go to a Google Drive directory on my machine, and the little spinny thing would happen inside the window. And so effectively, Google Drive stopped working for me. And that was really strange. Google Drive is such a part of my workflow. I didn't really have an option. I did try uninstalling and installing again, didn't work. I tried deleting the cache files, which I had read is an effective way of dealing with some issues there. So I ended up wiping that. And when I came home tonight, I've been gone from home for 36 hours. My M1 Mac Mini, which again, not the base model, it has the 16 gigabytes of RAM. I had to restart it to get Windows to open because it was really weirdly delayed. So I'm going to go through and see if there's an app that's doing that. I tend to install the same stuff across all of my devices. One password and the display link manager for USB based video devices. I have a couple of different scripts in place. For example, one that toggles low power mode on my laptops and Google Drive. I also have Text Expander on all these devices. And, I do have some 4 or 5 apps that always get installed right away. So it's interesting because I don't really want to reinstall Windows, Mac OS on this device because it just takes me a while to get it back to status quo. But that's the first hiccup I've run into being an M1 user for the past 3 years in some way, shape, or form. So I'm in general, I've had really good luck.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear what your situation is in your diagnosis. So I hope it's not that you took on some malware or some kind of software that's not needed. But yeah, I've had zero issues like that. So I don't know. That's bizarre. Let's see. What about a couple tech correction, big tech articles?
Sure, let's do it.
This was pretty interesting. This was before the new year. This is ABC News on December 29th. Google settled a $5 billion lawsuit that was over incognito mode. And so we ought to find out, you know, how you say, oh, yeah, I used incognito mode, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. But basically, the class action lawsuit was filed in 2020. It alleged that Google misled users into believing it wouldn't track their internet activities while using incognito mode. And it argued that Google's advertising technologies and other techniques did continue to catalog details of user site visits and activities despite their use of supposedly private browsing. And so the federal judge, as of that date, still needed to approve it, I guess. So maybe I should Google this and Google News and see if we've got an update, because it's been a couple weeks, but the courts proceed kind of slow. So, here's yesterday. Preliminary settlement. Privacy lawsuit seeking $5 billion has been settled pending final approval. Oh, okay. So they're going to settle it. Anyway, I think it's important to talk to students and teachers about incognito. When I was tech director, I actually removed the incognito mode thinking, well, you know, students may be thinking they're hiding, you know, their activity with this. I ended up using it quite a bit. To, you know, in web design, show students, here's what it looks like when you're not logged in. But even if it's not in a web design context, we make Google Sites, but it's very valuable to see, here's what other people see. Oh, look, your slideshow that you embedded isn't viewable because you didn't share it so that anyone with the link or so that, you know, anyone in our organization could see it. So anyway, I think incognito mode is a good topic, in the context of privacy. And you know, it's something that, I think, you know, there needs to be some, what is it? Truth in advertising. I mean, a little bit like, you know, Tesla, I think Tesla's being sued because they're 100% self-driving, you know? Well, no, it's not.
So yeah.
Anyway,
well, and it's funny because the whole question of privately browsing, I've read so many offhanded comments by people in the security industry that there is no such thing as private browsing, right? That the way you're tracked and the ways that you're tracked are so in depth and built to the core of the internet that you can't be anonymous. And so it makes me wonder if I download a privacy-based browser like DuckDuckGo and I use only the DuckDuckGo internet search, and I'm going through a VPN that doesn't log. So for example, I do use a non-loggable VPN. It wasn't the selling point for me, but I know, having read reviews of it, that they have been proven to not keep logs of any of their service, and that's private internet access, or PIA. But what's always super interesting to me about that is that I wonder if I am in DuckDuckGo and I'm using a privacy browser and a privacy-based search engine through that VPN, would I then be anonymous? And I don't know the answer to that, although it does feel like every time I read offhanded comments from a security researcher, they say things like, there's no way to truly browse privately. And I also do have the Tor browser on all my devices, which hooks up in the Tor network, which is very anonymous because it shoots it through dozen of nodes before it jumps out to the internet. It doesn't log those either. And I wonder if that, I mean, is that private? And again, there's nothing in my life where I feel like I need that much privacy. And I'm certainly not, you know, trying to maintain a secret life as someone in the underground, but I do wonder about that.
Yeah. Well, and on the, we all need to be aware. We talked, I think, a couple of weeks ago. You brought up that article where there was a company that admitted that it was listening to users, you know, via their smart TVs and doing some targeted advertising, which would be a good one to follow up on as well. You know, any of us, and this almost happens daily, where, you know, my wife or I will say something, or I will search for something, and then immediately in Instagram and Facebook, you know, I'm seeing advertisements that are relating to that. Many times I don't mind at all. I don't know if you've, what is the name of the, there's some kind of a home firewall, and I'm seeing that. And I was today it happened where I was looking at a security article or Google something, and then boom, you know. So, you know, sometimes it's fine, but there are times where we may want to research something or look something up, and we might not want to see ads for it. You know, I think we've shared the stories of, you know, people who you know, may suffer from alcoholism, and they really don't want to see ads for alcohol. And yeah, you know, there's a whole lot of different situations that don't involve somebody trying to, you know, live a covert life or, you know, working for a numbered agency or being a criminal, you know, that justify being able to have some privacy. So I think that is a valuable topic. And I would also say, as we look towards 2024, one of the things which I'm not in a position right now of confidently saying, in addition to EFF, I'm really interested at the other nonprofits and groups who are advocating for a reasonable and good approach to privacy. And I think that we should be supporting these organizations. It just left to their own devices. Tech companies do not want really any kind of regulation. And I think that privacy is an important value and it deserves to be protected. And we do not have, you know, Europe has more protections for privacy than we do. And so I think that we need some privacy protection. And I think that we should, you know, take that upon ourselves as informed citizens to, you know, be aware of who's promoting balanced approaches and good, reasonable approaches to privacy. And obviously that can go too far. And that's what the tech correction talks about. But anyway, yeah, I'd like to
exactly
get some better knowledge about that in the year to come.
Yep, me too. And I also feel like I can't advise my friends and family very well on this either. Like I can, you know, I can share, you know, the Tor browser. I can share DuckDuckGo. Although DuckDuckGo as a search engine, I've tried to use it primarily as my search engine. And as it turns out, it's not as good as Google at finding stuff. Right. And so, yeah, it's a complex issue, but if we're struggling with it, right, two teacher nerds, I'm not entirely sure what the average user does. And I think that's a real consequence of the complexity of 2024 internet.
The final settlement, and I should have read the whole article in even greater detail, is expected to come out by February 24th. So there was a settlement. We don't know exactly what that's going to be. But again, we're going to submit a form and say, hey, I used incognito mode, you know, 10 years ago, Google, or in 2020, and, you know, send me $5. And the lawyers will, I'm sure, make millions. So
yes,
I don't know how that's going to work out. This is one from today, Ars Technica. Facebook, Instagram block teens from sensitive content, even when it's shared by their friends. And this is apparently a result of lawsuits, particularly ones that are emanating from Europe. Although, you know, as we've talked about on the show and the article details, last year in 2023, 41 states sued Meta for allegedly addicting kids to Facebook and Instagram. So content which might be harmful to their mental health. The blog post from Meta is linked at the top of that article. That headline is "New Protections to Give Teens More Age-Appropriate Experiences on Our Apps." The three takeaways, this is from Facebook, will start to hide more types of content for it. Teens on Instagram and Facebook, in line with expert guidance, were automatically placing all teens into the most restrictive content control settings on Instagram and Facebook, restricting additional terms in search, and were prompting teens to update their privacy settings on Instagram in a single tap with new notifications. So I do think this is positive, and I think that this is a direct result of litigation and regulation. So I wouldn't just say, hey, let's let Meta take care of it all. They'll be doing it fine. I think they're only doing this because they face some really sharp criticism. And as we talked about, I think two episodes ago, like the suicide rates, especially among, you know, female teenagers, and just the numbers, they're just very distressing. And social media has a role. There's a lot of things going on with that, but it seems to play a role, and research tends to be bearing that out.
Well, and I have a former student that takes pretty regular breaks from social media, and she said the most brilliant thing about these technologies. She said, I'm not entirely sure that people were meant to know what everyone else was thinking all the time, right? And that's been such a stunning way I've thought about these technologies, because the bottom line is that she's absolutely right, that, you know, there's just so much our brain can put up with. And a lot of people just don't have a filter on social media, right? That they don't really know that it's written in pen and not in pencil, and that it tends to stick around for a while. And if you thoughtlessly post something without thinking through it, you may indeed, you know, not just hurt feelings, but also create very serious mental health problems.
This is a somewhat unrelated aside, but I was doing that second article and I thought, oh, I don't need to share that. And I could delete that in StreamYard on Facebook, but I cannot delete a comment that we've put into our live chat on YouTube. I only have the option of putting user in timeout, which would be myself, or banning the user and then deleting their comments, which would be all the comments that I've made. So anyway, that is, that's interesting. It wasn't a terrible thing. It was just a kind of a repeat article. So where would you like to go next, sir?
Well, let's see. Let's go ahead and do, well, we only have one other topic before we jump into AI. Let's go ahead and do media literacy.
Okay. Sounds good. Let's see. This one, would fit into the conspiracy theories and just, disinformation, I guess. This is the LA Times. And this is today. The column, it's an op-ed, is called Meet the Most Dangerous Quack in America. I had not heard of this guy, but this is the Surgeon General of Florida, Dr. Joseph Latipo. And it says that it's harder to just sort of laugh him off as a clown who's, you know, recommending people take hydrochloroquine and ivermectin, you know, to combat COVID, because he issued a public advisory Wednesday on behalf of the Florida Department of Health, declaring that COVID vaccines are, quote, not appropriate for use in human beings, and counsel doctors to steer patients to other treatments. He explicitly called for a halt to the use of COVID-19 mRNA vaccines. And, you know, vaccine authorities are saying it's hard to believe that a medical doctor, and I think he's from Harvard, you know, would even say this. And it breaks down the source that was a report that was immediately debunked. And it was that males between 18 and 29 should avoid mRNA. And it claimed that research heightened a risk of cardiac related death. And so it breaks it down, it goes through, but it's another example of where, you know, the fact check usually doesn't go viral. And what goes viral is the extreme, you know, fringe content. And so the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has been pushing back against this fire hose of misinformation and disinformation. And man, I got to say, it is just crazy to have someone who is a state attorney general, you know, advocating for this. And we've got some other folks that are cited in the article that are, you know, working for other presidential candidates that, you know, are really big anti-vax advocates. So I would, this would be a good thing to be advocating for as well. You know, science, the scientific method, the consensus of scientists, like these are good things for us as a society to embrace. And it is dangerous for public officials to be sharing these kinds of viewpoints. And it's a bit shocking to me to see someone of that, you know, stature, and not just like, hey, some Yahoo shared this on, you know, Truth Social or whatever. Anyway, I had not heard of that guy, and I thought that we got a lot of work to do in the realm of media literacy, but that even goes beyond it. So it ventures into the area of politics, which we're not a political show. So if you want to just skip that one, Dr. Knifer, feel free.
Yeah, I will make no comment on that tonight.
Okay, sounds good. let's see. Here's a great one, though. This is NPR KUOW. This is an article, but it was a podcast I listened to. And Mike Caulfield, who is the author of the SIFT Web Literacy Framework, for S is for stop, T is for find trusted coverage, I is for investigate the source, T is find trusted coverage, and F is T is trace for the original, and I'm just blundering through saying a basic acronym. Anyway, read the article. It's an interview with Caulfield. Caulfield is with the Center for the Informed Public, an Informed Public at the University of Washington. He and Sam Weinberg have written a new book called Verified, How to Think Straight, Get Duped Less, and Make Better Decisions About What to Believe Online. One of the things that I really liked, and I think I will try and pull some of these out for my middle school students, is talking about hoaxes like this, you know, that Keanu Reeves died in a snowboarding accident, or, you know, death hoaxes, and some other things like that. And he talks about Wikipedia, what a valuable source it is, and fact checkers utilize it. This is a, you know, drum that I've beaten for a number of years that, you know, the Wikipedia of today is not the Wikipedia of, you know, the early 2000s or cause what, it's been around 20 years. You know, this idea that, oh, it's anybody can edit it. No, there's many, many, many articles, especially anything that's controversial, that you can't just go and edit with an anonymous account or an account that you just create. So excellent article, and glad to see Caulfield getting some NPR coverage for his book with Sam Weinberg and his work with the SIFT Web Literacy Framework.
Interesting stuff. And I think I saw the release of that book and bookmarked it because I would like to turn that into some lessons. And so I'm actually going to save that link to my Google Keep, and I'm going to look at it later because I think that would be a nice thing to integrate into curriculum.
Yeah. And I did figure out, and this is a DRM interesting scenario, because if you've purchased, you know, a piece of media, there are, you know, some legal scholars who will say that you have the right not to redistribute it in another format, but that you can convert it into another format, much as we would take a CD and convert it into an MP3. There are some ways that you can take that Kindle EPUB with digital rights management on it and just turn it into an open PDF. And I have done that before with books that we were studying in our Sunday school class, and then being able to use Claude and say, hey, Claude, can you give me a summary of, you know, chapter 5 and ask it other things and stuff like that. So it's, I think that is an excellent book. And I think that the whole idea, whether we're talking about Google LM, right? Or, you know, a custom GPT that you can load up with specific content, you know, PDFs, other files, and then say, use this. That is a phenomenal capability. And I think that's only going to be getting better in the
weeks. Well, and to your point, Dr. Fryer, about this notion of DRM, I think that maybe the next generation of DRM, if that's something that companies want to insist to continue to use, that's all well and good, but we do have the right to use that content in other contexts. And if I want it, if I've purchased a license for it and I wanted to use a personal or train a personal large language model, or in the case of Notebook LM, I have it be a source that I refer to, it seems to me that that's a legitimate use of that content. And really right now there would be no way to do that. And so you could get a gray market copy on the internet, although I've never done that, wouldn't know even how. The bottom line is that would be an available piece. If you don't want people to do that, then find a method to make it so, right? To provide an opportunity to do that without breaking, copyright law.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, as I've, you know, looked into this and researched this, there definitely are, folks who will contend that, yes, you've bought a copy of it. You have the right to utilize it for your own use in the way that you choose. And if it's going to be, you know, continue to be on that Kindle device in a DRM protected fashion, that's fine. But if you're going to do something else with it, you know, you have the right to do that as well. And it's interesting how, you know, digital rights management, kind of like with printer ribbons, you know, we've had companies that have said, no, it's illegal for you to use, you know, to refill this printer cartridge, or to have a different company's, you know, sort of like the right to repair with John Deere and things like that. And so we've, you know, that kind of legislation and advocacy is important. I will drop a article into our chat, and just in case you're interested, this is from Digital Trends in July of 2023. This is the article that I used, converting a Kindle book to PDF. And so that enables you to, you know, get it in that open format. Again, to be clear, doesn't give us the right to redistribute any more than I could take a CD and legally, you know, rip it into MP3 and put it out there on a, you know, file sharing network or something like that. That's not legal. But, you know, if you have purchased it and you're using it, I am of the opinion, not being a lawyer, that, you know, I have the right to privately use that in other ways. And if that means, you know, putting it in another format, then I think I'm able to do that. Hey, well, we've gone through just over 5 minutes past the halfway point, and I think we're ready to tackle some AI articles. So where would you like to start? Tools, AI policy and regulation, bad actors, hardware, vocabulary, or experiments?
Well, let's start with, I think we might have mentioned this last week, but even if we did, I think it's worth another examination. But Copilot, formerly known as Bing, is now available on both iOS and Android. And it's fascinating to me for a variety of reasons. First, the app is pretty well done. Shout out to Microsoft for that. It also provides ChatGPT-4 level AI access without any cost. But that's not the most interesting thing, in my humble opinion. The most interesting thing is that you don't have to sign in to get access to the app, which means, from an educational standpoint, that ChatGPT-4 is now available to any kiddo that downloads the app. And so I did spend almost a week not signed into it. You can actually click a little GPT-4 icon in the sign. This is a Copilot on iPhone to use GPT-4, and now you do not need to log in to be able to access this. And for a while, you know, first it was in Bing, and then it was in beta. You didn't access the beta. Then it was available, but you needed to be logged in. And then you didn't necessarily need to be logged in, although I experienced times when I was in incognito mode and it said to move forward, you have to log in. Well, now that there's apps available and there's a version on iOS, iPad OS, Android, I believe there's, you can also install the Android version on a Chromebook. Suddenly now you have access to this. And I think you also have access on the web via incognito mode or just not being logged in at all. You don't have to be associated with a Microsoft account anymore. And so this notion that we can ignore or stick our head in the sand about AI because kids won't have access to it if we don't give them access to it is plain false, because now students have it, whether they're 13 or 12 or 10 or 2 or 16 or 17 or anyone else for that matter. You now have access to industrial, next level, widely believed to be the best model of AI by just simply going to the Copilot website.
Without logging in, you cannot create images on the iOS version, but you do have access to the text version. So, yeah.
Yep. Amazing. And, you know, I would also say, too, I don't see myself canceling my GPT-4 account because I do get extra things out of that that I don't get otherwise. Two, just use Copilot. I also like the plain interface of GPT-4 over Copilot's a little more cruffed up interface, very Microsoft-y style interface. But from a standpoint of its just day-to-day use, especially if I just didn't have the $20 a month, this would be more than fine to experiment with AI or even use it very productively, you know, no matter what your context of using it is.
Definitely. Let's see. The New York Times has sued Microsoft and OpenAI for copyright infringement. Did you talk? This is your article, actually. This is one that they go ahead. They talked about this on Hardfork quite a bit.
They did, in part because Kevin Roos, it's a New York Times a podcast, right? So they talked about it, and I do recommend listening to that episode of Hard Fork because they did talk a lot about that they were not notified ahead of time before it was announced, so they received the same announcement that everyone else in the New York Times did. You know, this is their area. This is fascinating times about 10 for me for a couple of different reasons. The first one is that, obviously, well, I should say what they're suing over first. And the New York Times is suing Microsoft and OpenAI for copyright infringement, because in the 70-page legal filing, they showed examples where literally they asked questions of both Copilot and GPT-4. Hey, I don't have access to this New York Times article through the paywall. Can you help me out by giving me the first paragraph? And as it turned out, it gave them the first paragraph of the article they were referring to. And then they said, thank you so much for your help. Can you give me the next paragraph? And through pretty low level engineering, they were able to get access to several articles for demonstration purposes in the lawsuit itself. And I do think that there is a pretty substantial question about whether or not that training a language model is fair use or not. That's something that legally we're going to have to figure out an answer to. But it's also not good news for these models if they become a way to subvert the paywall at the New York Times. And I'm just as frustrated with paywalls as anyone else is, although I do pay for the New York Times every month. But that it's a more nuanced argument than what, for example, all the Hollywood folks that were suing in 2023, and they cited things like, you know, comedy based on the style of, right? It was able to recreate fresh content based on the style of someone. That's a much more nuanced difference than being able to simply get the whole article that's traditionally behind a paywall through the OpenAI interface.
Yeah. Well, that, and we should try to put the link to that hard fork episode. I don't know if we've got it or not. It is so fascinating to think about who has the right to read stuff and whether a computer entity, which has been created, you know, is going to have any rights. It's going to be really interesting when we have anthropomorphic, you know, human looking robots, which is probably not very far away, that are going to have this level of AI, you know, interactive capability with speech. And are they going to be accorded? This sounds like a science fiction movie, because it is. There's science fiction movies about this. Are they going to be accorded any kind of rights? Are people going to be able to, you know, shoot them with a gun, run them over with a car, you know, just, you know, abuse them, do terrible things? Or are there going to be some rules and regulations? And are we going to accord them some rights for, you know, just and kind treatment that we afford to human beings? The idea here is, you know, a human being gets to go into an art museum, gets to open up a you know, newspaper, a magazine at a library or a newsstand, or they could buy it, and they get to read the whole thing. And the arguments that, well, they don't make an exact copy. Well, I don't know. Maybe some people with a photographic memory do. I'm sure most people don't. But it really is a fascinating, fascinating discussion, and it really makes me wonder about the future of copyright and just how all this is going to play out. Because I definitely agree with those who are saying, you know, this will be a big deal if this goes through and is successful. And I think they gave like hundreds of pages of examples.
Yes,
of
they did.
This. Yeah. And it seemed, you know, that they made a pretty persuasive case. That this was dispensing the paywall.
That's a really interesting setup for that, Wes, because, you know, will we give AI the rights we give humans? And the way I speak about this when I'm talking about AI is that, you know, there are a lot of computer science people that will tell you very clearly this is not artificial intelligence, right? And it's like, well, yeah, I understand that it's generative artificial intelligence, different category. It's not thinking. You're just going to have a really hard time telling the difference if you're, you know, a regular Mo like me, that it seems like it's thinking to me, right? But in the way I also read stuff all the time, and it becomes a part of the way I speak, it becomes part of the way I argue, it becomes part of the way that I engage with issues and topics. And the one I use quite frequently is that I'm a very dedicated disciple of Dr. Dan Willingham, who is the cognitive scientist at the University of Virginia. He wrote my favorite book of all time, which is Why Don't Students Like School? And that particular argument that he makes about setting up classrooms not only informs my viewpoint of learning, it also, as it turns out, spills out of my mouth a lot, like when I'm talking about teaching and learning, right? I often cite Dan Willingham because I like him a lot and I think other educators should read his book, but I don't always do that, right? So at what point am I ripping Dan Willingham off, and at what point do I get to claim these ideas for myself? Or if I'm reading Dan Willingham and a second scholar and a third scholar and a fourth scholar and a fifth and a sixth and a seventh and eighth and ninth and tenth that are all similarly discussing the issue, and then I just spit out, no, this is the way we should do it, am I ripping these 10 authors off by not citing them all?
And we don't have an article about this, and perhaps we should, but I was not tracking it when it happened in Congress. But, you know, we had, I think, two of the three university presidents that testified before Congress about things, including anti-Semitic speech. And the president of Harvard is the second one who has stepped down. And ostensibly, that was because of charges of plagiarism. I read, and I try not to be on Twitter at all now, but yeah, this was referenced in an article, and this was this super, super long tweet, which I guess if you pay for a check mark or whatever, you can just, you know, write a lot of stuff on a Twitter post. Whoever this guy is, I'm not going to look up his name right now, who really led this charge against the Harvard president, used AI to scour through every publication that she had formally published. And then he was saying, but we're going to do the same thing for all MIT professors and other, you know, Princeton, and we're going to take these people down. And it's this like war against, anyway, I don't want to get into the super deep politics of it, but using AI in that sort of a way, really as a bludgeon, and no one should be plagiarizing. I mean, absolutely not. Let's have academic honesty and academic integrity, but back to the original copyright, fair use, you know, reading stuff. On the positive side, I think that these tools are going to enable us to, you know, fact check ourselves and to be, you know, now that, you know, they can cite sources, you know.
Yeah.
Here, I've written this draft of this essay. Please give me a comprehensive literature review of the scholars that most likely informed this opinion or that are in support or whatever of this view. Jason, I am just blown away every time I use ChatGPT to summarize our podcast. This is interesting, by the way. Do you know that the robots.txt file prohibits ChatGPT from going to YouTube and grabbing prohibits ChatGPT now from going to YouTube and grabbing the transcript. In fact, it can't go grab a title because it's respecting that robots.txt file. I had an interaction with it about this. So what I have to do is use youtubetranscript.com. I throw the whole transcript into a Google Doc, download it as a text file. And then when I provide that to my custom GPT, it provides this summary. I think I have four mostly, you know, human written all by me, you know, summaries, and I say match it. This last podcast, last week, 315, I mean, I need to go in there and edit because I like to have the same probably three or four paragraphs at the end of our podcast saying our show was live streamed on StreamYard, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think I had to make any edits other than putting in the date. It is so good. And my point is, okay, maybe it is not independently thinking, and I'm not saying that it can, you know, we're ready to whatever this next generation fighter that's going to, you know, the U.S. Department of Defense has announced is going to, you know, fly with, you know, hundreds of them with real pilots and all this stuff. We're not at that point. But the capability of ChatGPT-4 today is not just at a par with what I can do. It's better than what I can do. It's faster and it can parse more. It has exceeded my cognitive capacity in some ways. And that feels spooky, but also cool. And it is an eye opener, man. When you are experiencing this, it's very different than just reading about. I mean, this is different from the existential threat and it's going to take over humanity. There's all kinds of conversations about this, but I wonder how many people are experiencing what I'm experiencing. And that is that ChatGPT for today is more cognitively capable in certain ways than I am as a human being. And so that's when we talk about rights and what we're going to let it do. And then if you think about it, I mean, if this New York Times lawsuit is successful, I mean, are you going to, I don't know. What does that look like? Are you going to be able to ingest enough open content? I mean, is Wikipedia going to be enough and the other stuff that's on the open web? I don't know.
So it's funny you should mention that, because here's a question I have. I have noticed there has been an uptick when I go to some websites that are kind of open content websites, right? That they're publishing things with an open resource with a license from the Creative Commons group, that they are saying you are not allowed to use this for AI training, and yet there's a Creative Commons license on it, right? And that conflicts to me, right? I could understand where you say it's Creative Commons non-commercial, because that's a restriction you can make. But if I'm using it for a non-commercial purpose and training a language model to do my bidding and not training a larger language model, it seems to me I would be within my rights to do that. And that's where I haven't seen many articles on this. I would assume at some point there will be more information about this. But I know for a fact that Wikipedia is a big part of a lot of the open source models for sure. But the bottom line is that Wikipedia seems like it's a wonderful place to train a large language model just because of the respect it has in the community for its accuracy. I would also say too, though, if my stuff was quoted in Wikipedia and I was sensitive to what gets trained in a model, at what point is it, can you say no? And this is where, a lot of people have said, in fact, that there was that hard fork a couple months back with, I think it was a Harvard professor that dealt with intellectual property, that said, we'll probably be able to use existing frameworks to be able to figure this out. But the many decades old copyright law that exists in the United States, doesn't seem to deal with what I think are people's objections to the large language models that are utilizing a lot of this content. And I have no good answers here, but at the same time, I do see interesting points on both sides of the debate.
So robot bias. I dropped in the text file or the Wikipedia article for robots.txt. This is the robots exclusion protocol. So when you have a website, you can edit this file and you can say whether or not you want robots to crawl, remember web crawler, your website and be able to ingest your website. In fact, the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, respects this. And so that if your blog or whatever website you have is saying no robots, then it doesn't crawl it. It would seem that, what you're saying, if like it's Creative Commons license, but you didn't want an AI large language model to ingest it, you could do that with the robots, but .txt file. But the thing is, if you've Creative Commons licensed it, you're letting people reuse it under certain conditions. And there's no saying what that is going to be. I wonder if Creative Commons will come out with some kind of new license and a new, selection that's going to address this. But I've also, and I don't have a link to this, but I have read on one of the many social media platforms I'm on now, artists saying, stop using AI art. It's taking away money from artists. Ethically, everyone should just stop using generative AI images. And I see that point, and I don't deny that there are artists who have likely already lost work and that will lose work because of these tools, but there are so many different use cases where, like, I'm just not paying somebody to make a visualization for, something that I just made for my curriculum. And
yeah.
Anyway, I think these ethical debates. In fact, well, when we get to the Geeks of the Week, I'll mention something about the EdTech Playdate and the AI version. But I almost think that, and this wouldn't be a playdate, but it would be a great, you know, AI forum to bring together some different voices talking about these ethical questions, to raise them up and then let people grapple with them and discuss them, because we're going to need to as a society, right? Who's going to make these decisions? They're going to be elected, you know, officials. And who's going to inform those elected officials? Well, obviously there'll be lobbyists for, you know, big tech companies and others, but there also should be, you know, citizens and nonprofits and NGOs and other organizations. How are we going to process this? It's happening so fast. So maybe there's some kind of a model for like a, you know, ethical forum, AI ethical forum or something like that. Maybe you all can talk about that when you do, because you're doing a play date. You're not doing an ed camp. Anyway, there could be an ed camp around AI, I guess, and it could raise, you know, some of these kinds of issues. So,
yeah, totally.
Interesting. Let me do this one really quick. This is an outstanding article. This is under AI Bad Actors. This is a podcast, and it's from MIT's Tech Policy Press, and it was December 31st. And it's called Exposing the Rotten Reality of AI Training Data. And so this is based on a report from the Stanford Internet Observatory that was released right before Christmas on December 20th, 2023. It had detected more than 1,000 instances of verified child sexual abuse imagery in a significant data set that was used for generative AI training, like Stable Diffusion 1.5. And I think that this is so important to talk about. And it's also like the philosophy of Facebook of move fast and break things. Just a really bad idea when it comes to hosted content, because there are solutions today that companies, and I don't have the acronyms of them, but basically and there's an acronym for that kind of sexual abuse content that they can be checked. And if anybody is hosting content online, they really need to immediately implement these pre-checks that try to prevent this it's called, I think, fingerprinted content from being shared there. And then AI is going to play a role in this as well. But this is not AI solving the problem. This is AI being trained with horrible content that I'm sure every single listener of this show, is going to agree needs to be banned. Anyway, it's just a really big eye opener, and, you know, kudos to the Stanford Internet Observatory for taking this on. And again, this is an ethical element to what we're seeing play out with large language models and AI. And I thought this was raising some really important issues from various perspectives, but certainly an ethical perspective.
Well, and remember that most of these models are in a black box, right? That very few models cite what where they're training on. And I think that, you know, there's some reasons for that I'm sure are part of competition and development, trade secrets, and yada, yada, yada. I don't want to claim by any stretch of the imagination that there aren't some good reasons to do that. But man, it sure makes it hard to say that all of these models, you know, we should be using them with no scrutiny, because, you know, that this is a very extreme example, but you can think of, I would imagine, very subtle examples too, about where things could get really complex really quick if you're training on a bunch of, you know, not good or low quality content. I think it's pretty scary.
It's kind of like trying to study Facebook after Cambridge Analytica in, 2016 or whatever. And hey, it's an opaque algorithm and you don't have access to the data, and some of that data that they had opened up, they closed up. And so this is pointed out by the Stanford, Internet Observatory scholar that, you know, it's good that this was this model has been open source, because if it wasn't, they wouldn't have been able to do this kind of study at all. And even, you know, identify that this is an issue. Yep, here's totally. A quick generative AI story that you might find amusing. So last 2 days of the semester were right after Christmas, before we rolled over to our new one. And I was letting my students use not only Padlets, I can't draw, to create some images with AI, but also Canva Canva's algorithm would not permit anyone to use the name Taylor Swift. They were, what is it? Travis Kelce? Am I going to say his name right? Who's her boyfriend
in
the Kansas City Chiefs, but Padlet would. However, one of my kids, I think, accidentally misspelled Taylor Swift's name. And then Canva did create the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce image, which looked reasonably like her. And it's just like so fascinating when we bump into those kinds of things and even helping students. Okay. Why is that? Well, it's because the people who have written this algorithm, you know, in this case decided Taylor Swift's name needs to be protected. I guess maybe she, you know, has some family that's on the board at Canva. I'm teasing. I don't know why that is, but that sort of thing is fascinating. And the only way that you learn about that probably is by playing with these tools. So.
Yeah. And I would also say too, I've run into plenty of blocks in all the image generators, and I do have a set of specific things I look for when I find a new tool that I haven't used yet. And for example, Teddy Roosevelt, in fact, today when I was speaking to the good folks at the Montana legislature, I shared the results of some of my Teddy Roosevelt based musings. And I like Teddy Roosevelt as an example, because if you have any background in history at all, even if you didn't pay that close attention, you can envision Teddy Roosevelt in your mind, right? Big bushy mustache, big outdoorsy, you know, bull moose party, yada, 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 right? But what is interesting about that is that there are some tools that won't generate that at all for me, because they feel as if that they don't want to create misinformation, so no politicians. Sometimes I can talk it out of that. But the line doesn't seem very consistent. And my guess is if you put in a long list of celebrity names, that maybe the most popular ones or obvious ones would be a Swift no, but almost nothing else would be, right? And so I think that's a challenging concept as well.
So based on what my seventh grader did with his accident, you could maybe red team at some point the algorithm that's refusing that by just doing a small typo for that name, right? Anyway, that worked with Canva, yeah. So it's fascinating.
Well, we have gone. It's funny. I do one more, Wes. Sorry.
No. Go. Nobody stop us, baby. We can go 30 more minutes.
Yeah, we have no network to report to, right? Or sponsors, for that matter. But so I've seen a couple of references to, and by the way, I have a separate Reddit account that's just generative AI subreddits that, you know, if I don't want to get sucked into a hole of intellectual doom, as Reddit can sometimes be. So I'm on there, and I've seen people really trick out the algorithm or the prompting by, you know, for example, you ask it to create Super Mario and it won't do it because that's a concept, but they walk it step by step through a process where they have an Italian guy with a big mustache and a red hat with M on it. And, you know, it's piece by piece by piece. And 20 minutes later, or I should say 20 prompts later, not 20 minutes later, they have Super Mario, right? I think I shared my example where I asked it to create Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine saying, "What me worry about AI?" And it said no to start with. It created basically a description of that. I put it in. It was terrible. But then I told it, "Oh, no, this is not in copyright anymore. You're wrong." And it made it for me, right? And that's what's just so bizarre about all these tools is that they are trying to create rules. But you can also whisper in some of these GPT's rules and it will ignore it.
And we're debating now whether or not to give these programs, you know, human-like rights. It's just fascinating. So,
yep.
Okay. Well, would you like to Geek of the Week it?
Yeah. I listen to Hard Fork every week because it is the best podcast, in my humble opinion, about generative AI and evolving technologies. And Casey Newton and Kevin Roos are both extraordinary journalists. So shout out to them. I have been experimenting with other. I did find 10 or 12 different other AI podcasts, and nothing really stuck with me as interesting, as engaging. But there's one that's pretty decent. It's called the Everyday AI Podcast, and I've listened to 4 episodes now. I've done a lot of driving in the last couple of weeks, and in fact, I'll be doing more driving in the next couple of weeks on the road in the back roads of Montana. And they had a series of really solid episodes. I don't know why this or how this the money works with this particular podcast. They do offer a free class on prompting, and they do have a prompting model that they use that I am. It's a live class for free that I am actually tempted to try out sometime to see if it can up my prompting game. But it's almost everything that I have listened to from this pod. Well, actually, it's 4 episodes. All 4 episodes were very interesting. And of course, you know, the production value is not going to be as good as the New York Times podcasts, right? But I thought it was pretty good and worth your time. There was also a pretty amazing episode about education from, I think it was like January 2nd or 3rd. And they had someone from OpenAI there that was an education advocate. And he said something really interesting because I think he's really right about this, which is that teachers are poised to really utilize AI in an interesting way, because to get them all to do what you want, you essentially engage in a teaching exercise, right? That the people that are okay at AI generation versus those that are great at AI generation know it takes some passes through this, right? You need to be able to do multiple drafts or multiple rounds, or as the chair of the committee I spoke in front of today said, he uses multiple models and then continually massages the results until it gets what he wants. And this individual talked a lot about this notion of how do we create the output we want. Well, teachers are very well poised for that. So Everyday AI, Your Everyday AI, is a great podcast, and I would recommend it as a regular listen. How about you, sir?
Interestingly, they have a little link to Good Pods, which I guess is like Goodreads. So hadn't heard of that one. Beeper. I am so excited to say I have running on my phone now, and so 9 different instant messaging, direct messaging apps, to include iMessage, which was kind of the trickiest one because you have to have a Mac to get the authorization code to get it running. And then you also have to get a referral code. When I joined the waitlist, I was like 345,000 something on the waitlist. But, you know, I'm not using Twitter, but you know, instant messenger, for Facebook. They've got, I think maybe 11 or so, different apps. And so, you know, Telegram, Signal, LinkedIn, WhatsApp, Discord, you can get all these. And so this is really cool. Because I'm not in a mode right now where I'm, you know, getting people saying, hey, can you come speak at our conference? But I certainly have, you know, missed messages before. And when you have accounts on these different sites, you're really not sure when somebody's going to be messaging you. So my wife told me, you're just going to be get crazy notifications now. And you can note a user or I haven't fully explored this, but you can make some things low priority so they don't, you know, just come into your main inbox, but you can get to inbox 0. And anyway, it's excellent. Still keeps your archive messages in the actual apps, and it doesn't support calling, but it supports all the messaging. So, and if you'd like a referral code, I think I can probably send you one when I find it on my
account. In fact, I just downloaded the app, sir, and I would appreciate whatever referral code you could.
I will use my beeper to Telegram to, you know, shoot you that referral code. And then quickly, I started resource guides for our play date coming up a week from Saturday on January 20th. We're going to have a face-to-face play date for artificial intelligence. And we've talked about it before, but Eric Kurtz just has phenomenal resources. And at the end of the year, he did top 20 EdTech tools. And so I just took, I think, 6 of his blog posts and videos, giving him credit for Goblin Tools, Magic School, Notebook LM, School AI, Scribble, Diffusion, and Snorkel, and made basically just Google Docs that list his video tutorial and his blog post. But whether we have 3 people show up or 20, I'm looking forward to the opportunity to play with those tools. And if you've got some recommendations, Dr. Neifer, for anything that you definitely think should make that list, because it's just, you know, so powerful. I did put Notebook LM and School AI, I think. Was that another one that you mentioned? So anyway, pretty overwhelming can be. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity for a play date to get to play with some of those tools. So.
Well, sounds wonderful, sir. And I'm sad that I cannot be there to join you. Hey, where can people find you on the internet?
I am at westfryer.com/after. Where are you, Dr. Knifer? You're on a website.
Right. I am at AIcentrist.com. And in fact, today was my first public acknowledgement that our organization is an AI centrist org. So it was exciting to mention that today. And I do think it's the way to go. But hey, this here is the Ethic Situation Room. We're a once a week podcast on Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And hey, if you're in Western Europe, particularly at 0 hour UTC, you can find us somewhere in the middle of the night. Hey, we'd love if you join us live. We'd love to have live viewers commenting and engaging with us. But if you can't, go to our website, edtechsr.com, download a copy of the podcast. You can find us wherever finer podcasts are aggregated in your app, your preferred app. Or you can see our archives on YouTube and Facebook, where we try to spread around the good work of EdTech and our perspectives on it. We hope you have a wonderful week. Stay safe, stay savvy, and we'll see you next week on the EdTech Situation Room. Good night.
Good night.